Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in History. I'm one of the hosts of the channel, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I am very excited today to be discussing a fascinating book that's just come out, The Cuckoo Cage, published by Comma Press in 2022. We are speaking today with the editor, Ra Page, and this is quite a unique experiment of a book that investigates the idea that while the superhero that we might be familiar with from comic books and films might seem to be quite quintessentially American, but actually this book argues that the cultural DNA of the superhero could possibly be traced to a much older progressive British tradition, larger than life folk heroes of historical protests across a number of different eras in British history, General Ludd, Captain Swing, Lady Skimmington, and sort of these semi-fictional identities that did actually happen in the historical record may in fact be an interesting way of thinking about the inspiration and the idea of superheroes that we might be more familiar with in the 21st century. So taking that idea, this book is a really interesting way of examining it by asking 12 different authors to each look at one of these historical traditions and resurrect it in a sort of current or near future Britain. What could that look like? Each of these stories in the book is accompanied by an explanation of the history that they're based on from academics in a number of different fields. And it really, the book together kind of pokes at this idea of what is fiction, what is reality, how do these things interact, particularly in terms of protest and politics. And it's both an entertaining book and also a really thought-provoking one. So it's wonderful that we have the editor of it today. Welcome to the podcast, Ra Page.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I was wondering, given that this is quite an interesting premise, if you could introduce yourself, your work, your background, and help us understand what led you to this book.
Yeah, so I set up Comma Press many years ago. I came, my original background is from journalism, arts criticism, but I also have a kind of science education background. And I set up Comma Press really to give a space in the UK for the short story. There was a dearth of places where writers of short stories could be published. And the industry at the time in the UK was just very resistant and very hostile to short fiction. So I set up Comma to celebrate and champion the short story, not just British short story writers, but international writers. The short story is very translatable and very international form in terms of its influence. So we do a lot of work in translation. And one of the interesting things that I discovered about, you know, I love short stories because of their form and their structure and their history. But one of the interesting things that I sort of discovered as I kind of grew into this role was how the short story lends itself very well to the points of view of the characters from the margins, the underdogs, the characters without particularly much audience. And Frank O'Connor, the Irish writer and essayist, summarized it most famously when he said the short story doesn't have a hero in the typical sense that a novel or a grander narrative, a larger canvas narrative has. What the short story has instead is what he called famously submerged population groups. And what he meant by that was the disenfranchised, characters who felt they had no stake in society and society didn't really represent or value them. As I say, underdogs, characters on the periphery, characters on the margins. And given that well-argued and quite demonstrable bias or leaning of the short story to those non-heroes, those untraditional heroes, those characters on the margins, those underdogs, it was kind of behoving on me to explore the relationship between the history of protest and people power and people's history, as opposed to the history that's written by the victors or about the victors, and the history that's written from the point of view of power. So I became very interested in kind of the great man theory of history, Thomas Carlyle's argument that history is but the biography of great men, which obviously everything that Comma does is in opposition to that. We don't believe that history is just the biography of great men and everybody else is just background material or background backdrops. Every character, every person, every individual, every citizen has as much to contribute to history and does contribute to history as anyone else. So the short story is also very good at allowing writers to do a bit of, it allows writers to explore territories that they wouldn't normally explore for the length of a novel. The problem is, doing research for a novel takes a very, very long time, and to do the same amount of research for a short story, if it's like a historical short story, takes a similar amount of time. But the short story is very kind of doesn't offer much reward for that investment. So generally, people don't do a huge amount of research for short stories, like historical research. So it's not really much of a genre within the short story tradition to do historical short stories. So what I came up with, it was actually in a different project looking at science and the way science interacts with fiction. I set up a template for writers to be paired with experts, with researchers, with academics. And initially I explored that through looking at science. So we commissioned a number of anthologies looking at different themes or different aspects of science. So that included the history of scientific breakthroughs, bioethics, science of sleep. We did a project on the science of sleep, the science of artificial life, and so forth. And in each one of those cases, we paired the writers with writers individually with scientists, and they produced a work that responded to the research. And then the scientists wrote an afterword that responded in turn to the story, but also explained the science behind it or the research behind it to a general reader. So we had that, what we call the science into fiction series. And then I applied that to the history into fiction. And obviously it was people's history, because of what I said earlier about the nature of the short story, it was people's history that we wanted to explore. So we brought out two books in a series about British protest. The first book was just called Protest, Stories of Resistance, and the second book was called Resist, Stories of Uprising. And in the second book, in particular, I came across a character called Rebecca. I say character, she wasn't a real person. She was a persona, a fictional character, who was the kind of figurehead of the Rebecca riots of the late 1830s. So in South Wales. So that was a strange series of events where men from a certain village in South Wales gathered together one evening and decided to dress up and pretend to be either Rebecca or the followers of Rebecca, other women who followed Rebecca. And they went off to protest against the installation of toll gates on a certain road going through their village. This strange performative protest, they ended up smashing up the toll gate. And afterwards, when asked who did it, they said, Rebecca did it. But this became, a couple of years later, a precedent for a whole series of riots, which went on, or toll gate smashings, which went on across the region. So this struck me as a very odd and interesting performative type of protest. But when I started thinking about it, there was actually a long list of other examples of this performative protest, where a movement got behind a particular identity. This identity may have been once a real person, but they've become larger than life and mythologized to the point of not being just that person, but being far more than that person. Or they could be a completely constructed identity for the purposes of anonymity. The latter was the case for the Swing riots, where threatening letters were written, signed Captain Swing or just Swing, to farmers and landowners who were introducing automation. And it was also, and there were other examples of protests gathering around certain identities, like the Luddites obviously gathered around General Ludd, who was loosely based on a real character called Ned Ludd. But those protests transformed and spread to the point where General Ludd was a mythic character. And then you see it elsewhere. You see it in much older, wider traditions of Charivari and Skimmington, Lady Skimmington, which were also called rough music, where pre-modern traditions of protest and disorder and carnival kind of all mixed together to create a precedent and a kind of a legitimate or self-legitimizing way of protesting against a certain wrong. So the interesting thing about this performative protest, especially in the case of Rebecca, was there was also a script that was read out and enacted. There was a kind of a call and response script between Rebecca and her followers before they smashed up a toll gate. So this kind of carries with it a certain amount of authorization, because this script has been written beforehand. Everything, you know, the community has agreed to this performance, and it shows a certain degree of process and legitimization around this. So it's not just a chaotic riot where, you know, hooligans smash something up. It's a very, very, very carefully calculated act and a collectively constructed performance. So that's what really got me interested in this particular subject. And as I say, we've now run three history into fiction books. The first two were about British history, and the third was about American foreign policy. And in each of those books, we had a piece of fiction inspired by the research, and then the researcher, the academic consultant, writing an afterword, a short essay explaining the history a little bit for the general reader. And it occurred to me that I've always, you know, from a separate point of view, that I've always loved superhero fantasies as a kid. I loved the 1980s Batman, the Tim Burton version of Batman. I love that idea of an alternative justice, form of justice. But then it quickly occurred to me that the superhero represents, in many cases, just another form of police or vigilantism, pardon me, which is very problematic and very conservative with a small c. So I was always interested in what would a political superhero look like, a superhero that didn't just fight crime or petty crime, effectively, but fought against social injustice. What would a superhero look like that fought against structural social wrongs? I was also interested in the way that people who are interested in kind of social wrongs are demonized and kind of mocked and ridiculed online by fan groups and right-wing groups, but often in just general discourse. They're referred to as SJWs, social justice warrior, and often there's kind of sexism built into that as well. And I was interested in this, in reclaiming this idea of social justice warrior and throwing the otherwise very, very neutral and dangerously, worryingly neutral world of the superhero into the kind of real politics and into what constitutes real social justice conflict and social justice protest. So yeah, those are some of the ideas that and the processes by which I came about this book.
Yeah, no, that really helps understand what brings into this book. And I think it's worth sort of bringing together those two points that you mentioned, the idea of how does this link to American superheroes? Well, in one sense, there's the idea of a persona, of a character. And that comes through really clearly in some of the stories I think we're probably going to talk a bit about. You've already mentioned Rebecca, that wasn't actually a real person at all. But there was a particular script, a particular ritual of how this was enacted, which is quite similar in a lot of ways to some of the classic superhero stories. But then also there's this idea that in some ways the stories told in this book are quite the opposite almost to some of these classic American superheroes in terms of what they're fighting against, who they're fighting for. And the book, I think, does a really interesting job of sort of poking at that idea of superheroes fighting for the little guy. But actually, what does that mean in practice? And some of the structural things might be more, might be defending the little guy more than going after someone who takes your purse or something like that.
Absolutely. And it's also pokes at the idea of, you know, how we define the little guy and how we define the defense of the little guy. It's obviously it's an American definition of the little guy. So it's the small businessman and it's defending his or her purse, as you say. It's about defending individualism and defending ultimately the kind of status quo, capitalist status quo that America enjoys. And it was very, very funny. The previous book to this, which was about in the series, which was about American foreign policy, I called it The American Way, obviously citing Superman, you know, a truth justice in the American way. And as that book was brought out, DC Comics removed the phrase The American Way from Superman's official kind of logo, because even DC Comics, even at the heart of, you know, American sort of self-aggrandizement, you have an awareness that the American Way, or just presenting, you know, justice as America and America as justice is problematic. So yeah.
Well, I think another interesting aspect that comes out from the stories is quite often the inspirations that they're drawing on in the book is from protests that happened in Britain that were against things like the increase of factories and machines, the enclosure of land, and so removing it from common use. And yet so much of the American superhero tradition is really heavily urban, is really heavily industrialized. And I think that that's an interesting thing to play around with as well, is what if the superheroes that are fighting, what they're fighting against is actually the exact same sorts of environments that superheroes we might be more familiar with today operate in without a second thought.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to compare the kind of the technological fetishization of technology, shall we say, within the classic American superhero, the love of gadgets, the love of new technology, you know, solving everything. You know, all we need is just more tech, more gadgets. With as you say, this kind of anti-automation, anti-mechanization tradition. And I was also I was also really interested in just as you say, the difference in landscapes between the two. With Batman and with Gotham, we think of Gotham as the coolest, most urban, most darkest, most, you know, rain-soaked kind of back alley stuffed shadow-covered kind of landscape that we can imagine. It's as you say, it's quintessentially urban. It's the peak of urbanness, Gotham, as we understand it. And you know how urban landscapes can become dangerous and scary through their urbanity. Mm-hmm. But ironically, the word or the name Gotham was a word, if you trace it back, was first used by the American writer Washington Irving in the 19th century to mock people from New York. He called them Gothamites, as in he meant they were all crazy. People in New York are crazy. They're like Gothamites. Because for him, and for many people before him, the word Gothamite refers to a book which just went through many, many different editions called The Merry Men of Gotham or The Wise Men of Gotham, which dates back to Henry VIII's time, which is a collection of very, very peculiar anecdotes about the villagers of a certain small rural village in Nottinghamshire, 6 or 7 miles southwest of Nottingham, in which one day, apparently, everybody in the village collectively pretended to be mad. And originally it was called the Madmen of Gotham, and it was later called the Wise Men of Gotham, because it was understood that the reason they were pretending to be mad was very calculated. King John was either trying to go through the village, and therefore the road through the village would become a royal road or a public road, and they would have to pay toll money for it and to use it. Or he was trying to build a hunting lodge. There's two different theories, but either way, the villagers didn't want King John to go through their village and to enter their village, so they stalled him and they held him up on the moor outside the village. And then when he sent his servants, his emissaries, into the village to see what the hell was going on with this place and why were they revolting, everyone pretended to be mad. So in a way, that village and that story of that village is again a collective performative protest. But bizarrely, its name has been applied to New York, and then DC Comics decided to base Batman in some version of New York called Gotham. And so we have the ultimate urban landscape actually based on a very, very rural and quintessentially British village.
And there are a number of ways in which we see this sort of this twisting of things play out in these stories. So you've introduced us already to sort of two of them. I was wondering if you could explain sort of how did you choose which historical inspirations to put in the book? And if you could introduce us to one or two more of them that got included.
Yeah, so what I did was I compiled a list of obvious kind of persona or collective identities. And I also consulted with many, many, many historians. Some of them I'd used on previous projects, and some of them I was put in touch with by other historians. So we compiled a very, very long list of these collective identities, sort of semi-fictional figureheads and pseudonyms that were used by protesters or critics of any particular sort of government at the time. And we then presented, and each one of those had a historian sort of consultant attached to it. And we then presented that list to the writers, and the writers sort of chose them sort of on a first-come, first-served basis. And there was some kind of movement sometimes. One particular writer asked Pete Kalu for a story about the sea, he wanted to write about water. He'd been researching and working a lot with kind of maritime stories and histories and research. So I went back and looked for a pseudonym or collective name that was used in maritime history, and eventually I found one in HMS Hermione. So Hermione was HMS Hermione was this the largest mutiny in the British Navy, in the history of the British Navy, and it came about because of a particularly abusive first mate, Hugh Pigott, I believe his name was, who beat various sailors under him, and eventually the crew just completely mutinied and threw him overboard. And not only was it the largest mutiny in British naval history, but it also came at a time right in the middle of lots of well, the immediate aftermath of lots of revolutions, the French Revolution, the Haiti Revolution, and others. So it was a very delicate time, very sensitive time for the British. And the vast majority of the mutineers were never caught, never rounded up. So for many years later, and for decades later, sailors often said or let it be known that they themselves were Hermione mutineers, or they had previously worked on Hermione as a way, as a kind of coded threat, but also as a way of gaining respect for them. Don't mess with us. So it became a sort of a collective identity. So that one wasn't a figurehead for a protest, but it was an identity associated with a previous protest. So we created this list, and the writers chose them, and some of them chose them because of their location. So in the case of Jacqueline, as the project started, I started commissioning it at the beginning of the pandemic, and obviously the George Floyd protests took off, and everybody's thoughts were about Black Lives Matter and about that kind of moment in our contemporary history. And several of the stories sort of pick up on it in different ways. And one of them was Courtier Newland's story. And he wanted to write, straight away, he wanted to write about Bristol because of what happened in the UK, obviously, with the toppling and the throwing into the river of the Colston statue, the slaver statue. So he created a character called Jacqueline. And Jacqueline, he flipped the gender. Jacqueline in the story is a woman, but Jacqueline in a Bristol context, historical context, was the name of a series of riots 300 years ago, which were against the installation of tolls, rather like Rebecca, and access to certain roads. In and around Bristol. So he took this and he relocated the character, made her a mixed race girl who had specific superpowers of being able to create interdimensional portals into other the portals to different parts of our universe, but also to other parallel universes. And she was a street fighter who by night would push slaver statues, hop around the country and fire slaver statues and other questionable memorial kind of statues and monuments into portals, like push them into other dimensions, just to remove them from our public spaces. This was being written at a time when the culture secretary at the time, Oliver Dowden, was saying if any museums try to follow suit and try to remove historical monuments or statues from their collections, or if any galleries try to do it, they will lose their funding. So it was slap bang in the middle of that kind of culture war that was being set up post George Floyd and BLM. And I was, you know, I was very conscious of that, and was very, very happy that Courtier was, you know, embracing it and going for it and, you know, not pulling his punches.
And I think that is, I'm glad you brought up those two stories because they do speak to a lot of current things happening today while also being really deeply rooted in the stories they came from. So Hermione's story, for example, the modern interpretation is a sea captain, essentially, using her powers of being able to breathe underwater to save migrants coming over the channel and take them away from the oppression of the system that both forces them to leave their homes and then how they're treated when they get to the UK.
Absolutely. So she works on a trawler, a fishing trawler, and it's with the exception of the captain, it's an all-woman trawler. And she has the secret power of being able to breathe underwater, and only her fellow crew members know about this. And yes, they spot a boat that's in trouble, a refugee, a dinghy full carrying refugees that's in trouble in a storm. And it's it's in turn inspired or influenced by a Caribbean legend, which Pete talked about. We launched it last week, and he talked about this legend in Caribbean folklore called the Blue Devils, which was this belief that, this story that many of the slaves that were thrown overboard and left to drown in the slave trade got up from the bottom, from the bed of the sea, and walked along the bed of the sea back to shore to enact their reparation, to take revenge, or to right the wrong that had befallen them. And they were called the Blue Devils. So he takes that idea and he applies it to the contemporary context of, you know, the refugee crisis as it's known, and British hostility to refugees, certainly refugees of colour, which has obviously been the hypocrisy around our hostility to refugees has obviously been exposed in the tragic events of the last 2 weeks, when there's been this outpouring, quite rightly, of sympathy towards refugees from the Ukraine, which simply isn't there when it comes to refugees from Syria or Iraq or Libya, or any of the places that where we have caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the really interesting things that comes through in the book, is this idea that it is very clearly based in this historical record and yet speaks immediately to things that we all experience in our daily life and see on the news all the time, before you even get to the bit at the end of the short story that explains the historical background. It always feels like something we can immediately understand and engage with. And you've spoken a bit so far about how you recruited the historical consultants for this project, and you've mentioned the writers. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about how you recruited these writers.
I'm really, really happy with this list of writers. It's slightly different to any of the other books we've done before in terms of the collection and the mixture of different writers. I've worked with most of them before, so in one capacity or another. So I'm familiar with pretty much all of them. There were two that I hadn't worked with before, but they came strongly recommended, and I knew their work. I'd seen their work online. Those being Divya and Lisa. Divya Galani and Lisa Lux. Some of the writers are moving into writing short fiction, having previously written poetry, like Gaia and also Gaia Holmes and also Lisa Lux. Some of them I worked with many years ago, and then when this project came up, and the kind of revolutionary heart of this project made me think of them, even though I haven't worked with them for many years. So MY Alam, who goes by Eunice Alam, he was a writer I definitely wanted to reconnect with. And obviously there's a very, very strong constituency of writers of colour in there, and also LGBT writers, but I didn't want to allocate them and say you do this, you do that, at all. I just let them choose their stories and by their through their own interests and what was grabbing them at the time. And I also wanted to kind of compare contrast the end of the worldness of the American superhero, because in American superhero narratives, it's always the end of the world. It's New York is always being attacked. Or Gotham, or Metropolis, or whatever you want to call New York, it's always under attack from, and it's always facing an existential threat. Which, when you face an existential threat, you kind of you rally behind your superhero, and you say, the world as it is fine. We want to defend that, which kind of instills in you a conservatism, and it says, let's keep what we've got. Let's be happy with what we've got. Let's be satisfied with what we've got, and let's save it. But that's not how this book works at all. By contrast, you've got Lisa Lux's shape-shifting character, Lexi, whose goal and the target, what she applies her supernatural superpower to, is robbing supermarkets for nappies and for bread and for baby formula, milk formula, and things like this. Absolute basics to then give to food banks and single mother support groups and so forth. So it's really superheroes fighting for the very poorest and using their superpowers to achieve, you know, the most modest of goals. They're not saving the universe. They're, you know, putting bread on the table, putting food on the table, getting nappies and milk formula for single moms living on the poverty line. That in itself makes us think about the world in which we're living, rather than get behind Superman or Batman or whatever, and defend the status quo and keep it alive, and, you know, glorify the world exactly as it is. It exposes the world exactly as it is, and it exposes the iniquities and injustices of food banks, et cetera, and poverty.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And this goes back to the idea as well about defining who is the little guy, which I think that story shows really clearly. So I realize that asking an editor to sort of pick your favorite is probably a very tricky question. So instead I'll frame it as not necessarily which story that ended up in the book was your favorite, but of kind of the different inspirations that were the genesis of these stories, or maybe one of the stories that came out. Was there a particular one that you find most compelling or most surprising?
So, I'm not going to pick a favorite because they're all my favorites. and I'll never be able to work with the writers again if I did. The opening two stories were really important. Luan Goldie's story, which is called Pause, which is about Lady Skimmington, and it's about a woman who decides to protest against the selling off of a part of her local park. Again, it's very, very modest. It's very local. But, oh my God, nothing hit the nail on the head quite so much as that story at the beginning of the pandemic, when parks were keeping us sane and keeping us alive. I mean, I would have gone completely crazy, and so would have thousands of others, I'm sure, if they didn't have access to a local park. Just to walk around, you know, repeatedly, day after day after day, the same path, going round and round and round like a rat in a maze. But parks were incredibly spiritually important to everyone, to normal people, certainly in the UK, certainly in urban or suburban UK. So that was a fantastic story to get. That particular character was able to freeze time. So you got some wonderful images of protests and sort of carnivalesque protests frozen in time, while she's also dressed up and mocking the mayor of the local council, who's trying to sell off this land to private investors and property developers and what have you. So that was really, really Good to Receive, and also Courtiers, which I've mentioned earlier. Those two stories were so timely at the beginning of the pandemic and early on in the pandemic that when I got those, I knew this was a project. I knew this was a book. Until then, it was just one of my crazy ideas. And when I got Luann's story and Courtiers' story, I knew I had to finish this. And every story that followed was surprising in different ways. I was incredibly pleased with the sense of place because I asked the writers to set their stories in different parts of the UK, in suburban, small town, northern, Midlands, everywhere, and countryside. So I was very pleased with that blend, that constellation of different settings, because whenever you talk about superheroes, when they do come to the UK, which is very, very rarely, it's always, the landmarks of London and, Tower Bridge and blah, blah, blah. It's never normal, familiar, local, provincial, British setting. So that was really, really important to me. There's lots of influences. Like the last story, I wanted to, this is definitely the most prescriptive project that I've ever commissioned. Usually, I just say to writers, take your pick, take one of these, go away, have fun. But with this, I was very, very prescriptive because they needed to work like superhero stories. And I knew that writers would fight against any prescription I gave. So I need to be as prescriptive as I could be, as they'd allow me to be. And as I say, most of them I've worked with before, so they kind of trusted me a little bit. So I wanted to create a space between the first 11 stories, which are effectively origin stories, and the 12th story, which we've called post-credit in the style of Marvel post-credit scenes, which sort of picks up about a couple of years later or a year or so later after the other stories, and finds most of the superheroes in jail, incarcerated, drugged up, and removed of their superpowers. And it's essentially a prison breakout story. And that's obviously inspired by this long history of cinematic tradition of prison breakout stories. In particular, Alan Moore, is a colossal figure and looms large over this project. Obviously, he invented the political superhero in a way with V for Vendetta. And he also kind of invented the use of superhero as a critique of culture with The Watchmen. So he's incredibly strong influence on this project. And he was a particular interesting influence on the final story because of there's a scene in V for Vendetta where V creates an entirely fictional sort of backstory about a prisoner who lives in the cell next to the woman that he's incarcerated, and about her past. And that fictional invented story of a fellow prisoner writing notes and pushing them through a hole in the wall was really, really kind of influential on the final story, as well as other things like there's a Marvel one shot called All Hail the King, which is like 3 minutes long, but it's very, very similar sort of stylistically, I think, to the last story.
And I think that gives us an idea, right? And I had wondered when I read it why that last story was a little bit different in a way, but it does work at the end of it. So it's interesting to sort of hear the thought behind it. And now that we've got sort of an idea of some of the different inspirations and some of the different stories that are in the book, I sort of want us to take us back to that divergence that we touched on in the beginning, the idea that although there might be a lot of similarities between American superheroes and these stories, these historical incidents of its protest, it's performative, it's resistance, it's framed as defending the little guy, there are also some pretty big differences in terms of who is actually the little guy and what is their relationship, what is the superhero's relationship to capitalism, for example, and industrialization. And it was really interesting to read about this link between these things, that maybe the British history of this inspired the American, and yet to see almost a complete 180 in a lot of senses of what we are now more familiar with. So I was wondering, given that you've been so immersed in this project and all these different aspects of it, if you had any ideas about why we've ended up with such a divergence.
That's a $35 million question, or a $60 million question, whatever the phrase is. It's a really, really difficult one. What I'd start by saying is that it is a 180. It is a complete divergence, as you say, but there are some aspects of it which are still there. So I'm, as an adult, as a literary editor, I'm not necessarily interested in, you know, Captain America or Marvel or whatever. I'm not interested in those stories. But what I am really, really, really fascinated and obsessed by is fandom, and the relationship between fans and fan fiction, and these meta-narratives that are continually rebooted and recast. It is a collective process, and it's a collective ownership. Some fans are so loyal, they'll like anything that's given to them, no matter whether it's well put together or not. Some fans are a little bit more discerning and have their favourites. Some fans live entirely in nostalgia. You could criticise parts of certain fandoms for just being obsessed with the past and just wanting to recreate their childhood. And there's lots of kind of social criticisms of fan groups. There's the man baby phenomenon where, you know, lots of men of a certain age, white men of a certain age, were very critical of the new kind of more, in quotes, woke versions of Star Wars. And then there was a criticism of them back, calling them man babies because they were so... they're so trapped by their own nostalgia and the culture that they grew up. They want to just continually recreate the same culture with the same values. So that really interests me. But it is a collective process, and the appreciation alongside the sort of slightly negative nostalgia merchants within any fandom, there is a huge amount of creative energy in put into the kind of the appreciation of these meta-narratives, and they are huge, huge meta-narratives. If you look at Marvel, it is colossal. It's hundreds of characters, hundreds of different universes, let alone different planets and timelines and everything else. The study of it, the aficionados, the obsession, exists almost out of sight or under the radar of popular, wider mainstream culture, although it obviously feeds into mainstream culture as well. And it's not as, I would argue, it's not as reactionary, it's not as conservative as it appears because of certain elements within it. And there's some very interesting research done on how people become radicalized and become, you know, far right wing nut jobs and because of, you know, in a process that starts with, you know, their particular fandom or their particular obsession becoming slightly more liberalized or being dragged into the 21st century in terms of its moral values. So there's a huge amount going on with any fandom. And I love the colossal amount of creative energy put into unpacking and decoding these works. And often there's you'll find breakdown videos online and Easter egg videos breaking down tiny little details that have been put into, you know, set designs and other things of films, which go on and on and on for hours and hours and hours around every installation they get, every installment, sorry, they get from of a particular franchise. That's not to say that other types of films aren't as creative and aren't as thoughtful in their set designs and their tiny, tiny little details. But in the superhero kind of, in the fandom world, you get people analysing and appreciating and breaking down that, whilst in more arty film, shall we say, or more literary works, you don't get that amount of granular appreciation and decoding and deconstruction. So it's a very interesting kind of world, that world of appreciation. So I wouldn't say that the American superhero is all about the individual. If you look at conventions, cons, you know, comic cons or whatever, the enjoyment is a collective process. It's about dressing up. It's about cosplay. Cosplay is a very interesting phenomenon in of itself. And what I was highlighting in the historical record and these historical protests was cosplay. So it's collective ownership of characters, collective ownership of the costumes and the paraphernalia they put around themselves. This is what happens at every convention, every Comic-Con you can go to. And it's a collective ownership of those characters. So it's far, far beyond the invention of one person or one artist. It's not about the artist. You know, Gene Roddenberry with Star Trek may claim to be the creator of Star Trek, but you know, he has no say in the latest, you know, Star Trek reboot, and nor should he. And you know, obviously he passed away many years ago, but even if he wasn't, he would have no say in it, and his say would be irrelevant. Just as in a way, George Lucas now has no say in the new Disney-owned kind of Star Wars spin-offs. You know, some of the good, some of them are good, some of them are bad, and it doesn't really matter what George Lucas has to say about them. So that collective ownership of a work is carrying on, and it's still there. So just as the original superheroes were collectively owned, the big difference I find is the relationship to the truth. And when I put in a footnote about this, because people, when I started this project and I was talking to a few people about it, they often thought that I was doing something about Anonymous. You mean like Anonymous? And I was thinking, yeah, well, there's an Alan Moore reference in Anonymous with the V for Vendetta masks. Obviously, it's connected to Anonymous. And then, you know, people then made the next step, which was to things like QAnon and conspiracy theories and things like the QAnon shaman who dresses up at the January 6th riot, the Capitol Hill, or things like that. And you just... And I wanted to make very clear that there was a difference here, the difference between that kind of anonymous protest, purely anonymous protest, and what these collective protests was about was their relationship with the truth. So QAnon claims to be, the original QAnon was somebody who claimed to have Q clearance, which is high level, top secret government clearance, access to blah, 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 government secrets. So he claimed to be a real person. So the QAnon phenomenon follows somebody who claims to be a real person, whilst all of the characters I was dealing with didn't claim to be a real person. They claimed to be a fictional person. They embraced their fictional side. So I want to separate those two things as well. And obviously, yeah, but to go back to your original question, you know, why is Superman there for truth, justice in the American way? Whilst these characters were obviously the opposite of that, I think it's to do with the industries which the superhero eventually found himself in, which was cinema. As superheroes progressed from comics, which were essentially kids reading materials, they were YA reading materials, through to cinema, they had to become not just kids' films, they had to become kind of family films for all the family. And with large scale, large amounts of studio investment, they would have to subscribe to a certain moral universe, and they would have to have certain kind of moral values attached to them. And Hollywood is essentially, it doesn't know it, but it would deny it, but it's essentially the PR department of American foreign policy, or American, the way America wants to be seen to the rest of the world, whether it's culturally or politically. So when it enters into that kind of world, especially the still slightly studio world of the 70s and 80s, it has to be has to subscribe to that set of, you know, the American outlook of the 70s and 80s. Whilst now I think things are changing slightly. You know, there's a fragmentation of production and the way in which we experience film and TV, obviously with streaming services and other things. I think it's not such a monolithic kind of advertisement for, quote, the American way, as it used to be, the film and TV industry, that is. Mm.
That's a really interesting sort of exploration, and touches on a lot of subjects, I think, come up in the book and are definitely of interest to our listeners. So thank you for sharing your thoughts on that, and particularly on the idea of Hollywood in relation to American foreign policy. Listeners who are listening to this right now, stay tuned. In April, we'll have another episode on this channel that is about a book that entirely focuses on that, titled A Righteous Smokescreen, Postwar America and the Politics of Cultural Globalization. So if that's a topic you are interested in, stay tuned on this channel. Now, again, this is a mean question, it always feels, to ask, given that your book has literally just come out. But you do describe the book in your editor's note as being a launch party, and you've already spoken about how this is part of a series, and you've already talked about how short stories can allow us to explore things that maybe wouldn't get explored in a novel, kind of gives a lot of avenues for exploration. So do you have any ideas of what you want to see come out of this? Is it going to be what you work on next?
Yeah, so absolutely. Well, I'm always working on lots of different projects within the publishing house, some of which are kind of my projects and some of which are other people's, but there's always many projects going on at once. So yes, as I say, there's a number of stages, next steps that I have in mind. The first is to fill the gap between the 11th story and the 12th story. So I was very interested in the idea of, you know, the grandiose American superhero saves the world, saves the universe every time, and has these, you know, absolutely cosmic achievements, whilst the shapeshifter who's stealing bread and nappies ends up getting caught and fails. I wanted to really juxtapose that, those two worlds, and I wanted to show that even with superpowers, in many cases, protest will face failure, because the history of protest is a long, sad history of failures. To a certain extent, you know, obviously there's some notable victories, but a lot of the time we find ourselves fighting for the same things that, you know, in a different form that people were fighting for a long time ago. And in some cases, we're fighting for far, far less than what others fought for, especially on things like access to common land and common ownership and things like that. So I wanted all of my superheroes to fail one way or another. So I wanted them all to be rounded up and, you know, or most of them to be rounded up and put in jail. So there's a big gap between, as I say, the 11th story and the 12th story. So the next commission, to answer your question, will be a part two of this book, which fills in some of that space, and obviously I want to bring in new characters as well. So, and it will also take it a little bit further after the 12th story. There's something very appealing about turning a narrative upside down, rather than having a happy ending, having a bad ending. Anybody that's interested in the fandom and some of the things I was talking about will know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Empire Strikes Back, which is an upside down film. It starts with a big battle, ends with failure, and is profoundly moving because it's so different in that way. And so that's like stage two. I've also, the writers of these stories have also agreed, you know, contractually, all of them agreed to the idea that these characters are common ownership, with regard to other writers and other graphic novelists. So they belong to the fandom. So anybody can write about any of them. And there's not going to be any copyright claims with regard to that. So that's to do with writers and graphic novelists, not to do with film adaptations, I should say. So at some point I want to start commissioning. But this is like stage three. I will start inviting graphic a graphic artist to start working on a comic book version of the same thing. Longer term, I'd love to go into TV and film adaptations of it, because the whole thing is conceived as a multi-platform meta narrative, really, something which exists in book form, in short story form, in comic book form, and in visual TV or film form.
Amazing. Well, I think there's a lot for listeners and readers to get stuck into. While all of that is in development, there's a lot of one of the things that I personally like about short stories is that they spark imagination, they spark ideas, and sometimes because they're short and don't necessarily have an end, they stay with you because you're still wondering about them. So readers and listeners, those of you who are interested in the book, it is titled The Cuckoo Cage by Comma Press, published last week, right now in 2022. And thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today, Editor Rob Page.